Hello, you are listening to America Unchained. I'm Chris Tidwell.
And my name is Richard Dean Winfield.
Today's topic is immigration. To what degree we can consider ourselves a nation of immigrants is a guiding question for today's podcast. So to look at this, we must turn to the history of what immigration has been like in this country. It's no doubt American history is a story of immigration. As one may know, that's why the Statue of Liberty, an enduring symbol of American spirit, is located on Ellis Island, opening the doors to our nation for the tired and hungry. But while the iconography is clear, the policy is not. We have had a long history of exclusion of immigrants and deprivation of their rights. And today, nativism has become a core tenet of the Trump White House and Republican Party. It is a spectacle of violation with their caging of children and separation of families and the Muslim ban. But how did we get here? So, Richard, I'm wondering, would you point to some important nodes on the timeline of immigration in America?
I think to consider the history, you first have to think about in what way we consider ourselves to be a nation of immigrants. Because today, certainly, we are a nation that has actually a larger immigrant population than any other. We have almost 50 million immigrants. And if you add to them the children of immigrants, you know, we're talking about more than 90 million people, make up almost a third, 28% of our population. The immigrants themselves are now about 14.4% of our population, or almost 20% of the world total. The foreign-born population in the United States is almost at a historical peak. It was reached in 1910, where 14.7% of the population was foreign-born. Now it's somewhat below that, but it's close to that. And before Trump arrived on the scene, you know, we would have more than a million legal immigrants arriving each year. Most of them came under some sort of family sponsorship, almost 70%. 13% were asylum seekers. 12% came in virtue of having work-related visas. And then about 4% came in on a diversity lottery visa program. Now, of course, there are people who challenge the idea that we are an immigrant nation, because obviously we have people who make up part of the United States who are not immigrants, who could be called Native Americans. And we also have African Americans who came here unwillingly, not as voluntary immigrants, but as slaves. Now, today, the Native American population is 2%. The population of African Americans is about 12 to 13%, but of the African Americans in our increasing number, actually from the Caribbean and increasingly from Africa itself, 10% of the African American population now consists of such immigrants. And what that means as a whole is that we have about 87% of our population does consist of what could be considered voluntary immigrants and their descendants. Now, this really is strikingly different from many of the other countries in our hemisphere. If you look at Mexico and Central America and that part of Latin America that goes down the Andes, the Native American population is of a completely different magnitude, where in many countries it makes a large majority of the population, or certainly is a very, very sizable portion. And in other countries in south of our borders, in the Caribbean, Brazil, where you didn't have significant numbers of Native Americans, you have much larger populations of what could be considered the descendants of non-voluntary immigrants, namely slave populations, which in Brazil and much of the Caribbean make up a very significant, if not a large majority of the population. The United States is something different. And if you want to think about what we've become, certainly what we've become as a global power has a lot to do with our being a nation of immigrants in this sense. You can think about the explosion of population in this country, where at the time of independence, we had barely 3 million people. On the threshold of the Civil War, we had close to 30 million people. In the South, you had 4 million slaves. You had over 8 million free people, most of whom were whites. The North had the remainder of the population, with a certain population of freed African Americans. But this population would then grow rapidly with an increasingly large influx of immigrants. And this is, of course, something that has continued. The United States had, when I was born, about 150 million people. At the same time, Great Britain had about 55 million people. Now, 70 years later, we have about 330 million people. Great Britain has only 65 million. We have become a major, major world power, if not a superpower, reflected in the way in which we have a much larger population than nations which have not had such a huge influx of immigrants. And if you think of our development as an economic giant, this largely took place after the Civil War, through a huge influx of immigrants, a vast new reserve of labor power that created new centers of wealth with all the robber barons and so forth. No longer was it a wealth connected to slavery. Slavery had established a large amount of wealth in the South, which contained most of the 1% of antebellum America, and had the greatest inequality of wealth in the United States. But then something else happened, a great explosion, which turned us into the industrial giant of the world up until the 21st century, where obviously things are changing. Now, I think an important consideration regarding our character as a nation defined by being largely comprised of immigrants is what this means for the identity of the nation. And part of that has to do with the connection between immigration and naturalization. Because there are different ways in which this can happen. You can have nations, of course, that do not allow for immigration in general. And there have been nations in history who have shut their borders very radically and maintained the kind of cultural unity that had been established and protected it from any kind of alteration through influxes of new populations with new customs, new attitudes, etc., new languages. But there are nations, of course, that have allowed for immigration, and at times unlimited immigration, but it's been tied to a certain ethnic identity. For example, in recent times, Israel and Germany have followed paths of this sort, where Israel was set up as a place where if you were Jewish, you could immigrate into Israel and you would be automatically naturalized. You would be granted citizenship. You had, so to speak, a right to return. Germany, interestingly enough, had something very similar after World War II, because what had happened in much of Eastern Europe was that you had large populations of Germans who had left Germany and settled in Eastern Europe over preceding centuries. And after World War II, there was a kind of ethnic cleansing, a revenge ethnic cleansing that took place where, in reaction to the brutality of the Nazi occupation, and remember, the Nazi occupation not only killed 6 million Eastern European Jews and 500,000 Roma, it killed millions of Poles. It killed millions of Russians and POWs from the Soviet Union. It also embarked on a plan to enslave the Slavs. And in response to this, there was an ethnic cleansing and expulsion of millions of Germans from Eastern European countries after the Second World War. And Germany had the policy that any German returning would be granted automatic citizenship. They would let them in. But at the same time, both Israel and Germany did not allow for open immigration and naturalization of other people. And you saw this in Germany, where at a certain point, the German economic miracle required a large sort of unskilled labor force. And they had a program of what they called Gastarbeiter, where they let in workers, many of whom ended up coming from Turkey, who were not given any path to citizenship. In other words, they had no opportunity to have naturalization. And in addition, their children, who were born in Germany, did not obtain German citizenship. Now, that is beginning to change. But it shows you how important it is how a nation regards immigrants and how it treats naturalization. Another option we find in the world today is that followed in many of the Emirates in the Middle East, which have huge numbers of workers, many of them from Asia, who are doing all of the construction work and also the highly skilled work. Now, these are allowed in as immigrants, but they are not given any possibility of naturalization. In other words, they cannot become citizens. Now, you can see that this represents a kind of wrong if one subscribes to the idea of political freedom. It's almost as if we're back in the situation of ancient Greece, where those who did the work as laborers were excluded from citizenship. And you can see that if you allow immigrants to come in, but do not provide them with any opportunity for naturalization, and you allow them to live their lives in your country, you are in effect depriving them of political freedom. Now, the United States purports to have a different attitude. You know, we have opened our doors to immigration, and we have, in certain respects, allowed for paths to citizenship for a large part of our immigrants, with certain exceptions we're going to discuss. But in addition, we have the very important measure in the 14th Amendment, which grants citizenship to anyone who was born in the United States. Now, these aspects, I think, are of crucial significance to how we view the special identity of our country in a manner that might give positive significance to our being a nation predominantly of immigrants. And that is that we're not a nation state. We're not a state where citizenship is tied to ancestry, to belonging to a particular people that has a culturally given identity. To a large degree, we are a nation where, in what it means to be an American, has to do with, in a sense, subscribing to the Constitution that applies to us all and being in a position to participate in its institutions. And in that respect, we have a kind of body politic that might be regarded in this way to be more in tune with the demands of democracy than nation states, which allow a certain kind of national identity, a certain kind of ancestry, to provide a privilege, a political privilege.
So it's certainly the case that most people consider America a melting pot. That's the cliche that gets used. And this maybe even goes way back to the Common Sense pamphlets of Thomas Paine, where he outlined that people of good character should be allowed into the United States. But I want to maybe challenge that a little bit, because we also, at the same time, while being having a history of immigration, we also have a history of xenophobia. From the beginning, there was problems with the Catholics, the Irish, Germans, edging even to just before the threshold of the Civil War and in the Industrial Age. Those seemed to be problematic people to bring in, according to a certain population of Americans at the time. And then after the Civil War, there was, of course, the Chinese Exclusion Act, which was one of the most radical policies to not allow anybody of Chinese descent into the country. And then even between the World Wars, there was immigration discrepancies, not letting certain people of certain races in. And then, of course, it is more prevalent today than ever. More prevalent today than that of recent history, I guess we could say. And just could you maybe touch on these instances of xenophobia that we see in America's history as well?
Well, I think to get a perspective on the way in which immigration and naturalization become matters of controversy and efforts of restriction, I think it's worthwhile to keep in perspective who are the people who ended up immigrating into the United States. To begin with, if you go way back to the 17th century, you had 400,000 people from England itself. These made up about 90% of the white immigrants. You had also the beginning of a slave trade, but it hadn't yet gained a lot of momentum. Up until our Revolutionary War, starting around up through 1775, there were about an additional 500,000 Europeans who entered the country after 1700, to add to the 400,000 English who had made up the bulk of the new population. Of these new immigrants, only 52,000 were English. The rest were Scots, Irish, German, Swiss, French Huguenots, and they were joined by 300,000 African slaves. And if you take what the population of this country was, leaving aside the numbers of Native Americans who were beginning to be pushed out of the colonies farther to the west, half of the Europeans up until the 18th century, half of them were indentured servants, 350,000 indentured servants. And then there was a gradual increase of immigration after 1820, which gathered steam and continued up until World War I, where 30 million immigrants, primarily from Europe, migrated into the United States. And the peak year of European immigration was 1907, when you had 1,285,000 Europeans entering the country. Now, since then, as we all know, immigration has radically changed. By 1970, the composition was beginning to alter, and for reasons we'll get into. 60% of the immigrants were from Europe, 40% were not. By 2000, that had changed radically, where only 15% of the immigrants were from Europe. In 2016, only 13% of the immigrants were from Europe and Canada. 27% were from South and East Asia, 26% from Mexico, 25% from other Latin American countries, including the Caribbean. In 2018, the immigration pattern was such that only 7.3% of the immigrants were from Europe. More than 45% were from the Americas, 36% were from Asia, a little over 10% were from Africa. So the composition, the ethnic identity of immigration has been radically changing. And of course, that is very much changing the composition of our population. So that by 2065, non-Hispanic whites will be a minority of the population, 46% of the population, down from about 63% in 2018. And if you look now at where are foreign-born people in the United States from, as of a couple of years ago, The leader is Mexico with 12.5 million. China comes next with 2,639,000. India is third with 2,348,000. The Philippines comes at 1.9 million. El Salvador with 1.3. Vietnam with 1.3. Cuba with 1.2. South Korea with 1.0. The Dominican Republic with about 1 million. Guatemala with slightly less than 1 million. So this gives you an idea of how the composition of the nation has been radically changing. Now, admittedly, there is and has been, and we'll look at the history of this, an opposition to immigration and also an opposition to naturalization of immigrants that is based in a nativism, which has what could be called an anti-democratic nationalism. That is, some type of ancestry is privileged over others. Those who do not share that ancestry are villainized, and this nativist approach wants to exclude from the people, from the nation, and from full citizenship, those who do not share this privileged ancestry. Now, of course, that is something that fascism takes to its logical conclusion. By taking one type of ancestry as that which will reign supreme and lord over all others, and obviously that is antithetical to any kind of equal political opportunity, equal social opportunity, even any equal kind of family opportunity, because instead a particular national identity is given an exclusive privilege. But we have to keep in mind you also have another kind of opposition to immigration. And that comes from those who feel their livelihood is threatened. And I know today there is this common narrative that immigrants, and particularly our undocumented immigrants, are doing work that non-immigrants don't want to do. Now, admittedly, those who are, let's say, relatively well-off or affluent are not seeking to get jobs in landscaping, in manual labor, and so forth. But there are people who did this work before. And anecdotally, I can refer to what has happened in Athens. On the outskirts of Athens, you have all sorts of chicken processing plants. Not that long ago, the employees in such plants were relatively low-paid African-Americans. But that was the work that they were doing, being at the bottom of the economic ladder in Athens, Georgia. Well, at some point, they ended up being replaced with immigrants primarily from Mexico, a significant number of whom were undocumented. Then, when the activities of ICE spread terror in this community, many of them left, and African Americans returned to take jobs in these industries. Now, you might ask, well, are these immigrants stealing jobs from others? And you have to ask yourself, well, how do you steal a job? You know, you can't unilaterally steal a job. Employers have to decide to replace their current work staff with others. And that's what many employers in the United States did. They took advantage of waves of immigrants coming into this country, particularly from south of the border, many of whom had come in illegally, that is, without authorization, and who thereby could be taken advantage of because they could not go to the authorities to try to blow the whistle on wage theft and payments below the minimum wage and a lack of any kind of overtime payments and so forth, that they were easily exploited. And as we all know, many employers in many walks of life took great advantage of this. Now, I think one of the reasons for why you have a rise of anti-immigrant nativism, not only in the United States, but in many developed nations, is that, first of all, people have reason to fear that they can lose a job. In other words, there is not a federal job guarantee, which allows people to know that if they get dismissed from their current workplace, they will have another job at a fair wage awaiting them. Instead, people have a legitimate reason to fear unemployment. And in a place like the United States, the fear of firing is even greater, both because we have such a low rate of unionization, which has reached 6% in the private sector, meaning in most cases, your employer is free to fire you at will. But then also you will often lose health benefits if you have any, and retirement benefits if you have any. And even in the countries in Europe that have very robust social democracies and robust health benefits and the like, they don't have a federal job guarantee. They don't have guaranteed jobs. So people are worried about influx of refugees and immigrants, of losing their positions. And the United States has a history of labor being opposed to increases in immigration. The American Federation of Labor, which had its origins in the 19th century, it was very much opposed to unrestricted immigration. And it played an instrumental role in helping pass the first restrictive laws that took place in this country. And we'll look at some of that history in a moment. Another more recent example is, you know, the United Farm Workers were very active under the leadership of Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta. They were very opposed to the Bracero program that existed from 1942 to 1964. That was a program that was like the guest worker program that Germany has made use of, where an immigrant workforce would be admitted into the country with no chance of a path to citizenship. And the United Farm Workers opposed that program because they regarded it as being something that basically was going to be undermining United States workers and would be something where the migrants would be exploited. And this would both diminish the employment opportunities of United States workers in agriculture and lower wages. And in 1973, Chavez led protests against the use of undocumented workers by the grape growers. And in this, he was supported by such political figures as Walter Mondale and also a civil rights activist, Ralph Abernathy. And the United Farm Workers actually went around reporting illegal immigrants to the INS because they considered them strike breakers, which they often were being used as. And in that same year, the United Farm Workers set up a kind of line on the border, a so-called wet line, to prevent illegal immigrants entering from Mexico and undermining the unionization efforts of the United Farm Workers. Another example of opposition to immigration and also undocumented workers is something that you find coming from Bernie Sanders, who generally opposes guest worker programs and is also very skeptical of skilled immigrant visas, H-1B visas, which he has written. In a sense, he says right-wing people in this country would love an open border policy, bring in all kinds of people, work for $2 or $3 an hour. That would be great for them. So there is this fear on the part of people on the left and of people in labor that immigration without proper restrictions is a threat to the living standards and employment opportunities of Americans. And I think we have to recognize that although there are some who tell this narrative that undocumented workers and immigrants in general may be doing work that Americans don't want to do, there are certain Americans who don't feel that way, who feel their opportunities are under threat. Now, I think in general, if one wants to deal with this issue, one should recognize that if one is going to deal with immigration, one has to think about how to do it in a way where no one's economic opportunities are going to be harmed by the immigration that one allows for. Now, on the one hand, it's quite obvious that the growth of our economy and our stature as, in a way, a great world power depends upon continued growth. Now, of course, one might say, well, who cares? Well, one might want to care if you think about the world as it's developing. India and China both have about 4 to 5 times as many people as we do. As they approach our standard of living, they're going to have economies that are going to dwarf us. They're going to have the resources to engage in military spending that will dwarf us, of course, in scientific research and the like. No, well, there's nothing wrong with this. The other nations of the world should be able to achieve whatever prosperity we achieved. But the question is, what will the character of the regimes be that will dominate the world? If we aspire to trying to be fulfilling the project of being a free nation, a free democratic nation with a free society that involves fulfilling our social rights, we do want to think about retaining an influence in the world. And to some degree, that's going to depend on our being able to continue to grow and be able to maintain a certain magnitude of economic influence. And that does depend upon allowing immigration to continue. That's not to say that we are increasing the population of the world. But if we were to continue immigration at its current level, we would end up, I should say before Trump, we would end up with a population that would be taking us to about 470 million people. 440 million people by 2065. If we clamp down on immigration, if we take the view that Donald Trump has expressed, that we are full, we will pretty much remain where we are. And because our reproduction rate is falling, you know, our population can actually begin to diminish. Now, if we want to think about the issues of having immigration in a way that is not going to in any way jeopardize the economic welfare of anyone who is here, an important policy that protects against that is none other than the federal job guarantee, which ensures that everyone will have a job and ensures that jobs will be at a fair minimum. And what will also help with this and ensure that immigration in no way lowers wage levels is employee empowerment, ensuring that all employees at enterprises with multiple workers are unionized and that they have seats on corporate boards. You know, these are, I think, very crucial measures that are part of removing the conditions that fuel nativism and the fundamental threat to democracy that that represents.
Well, these are interesting points that you bring up about the left possibly, you know, uniting with some ideas of closed border policies. But one interesting instance of immigration law that I'm sort of curious about, I think it's sort of relevant because the Trump administration likes to reference the Reagan campaign and administration as some of their primary influences. But during his tenure, he signed an executive order in relation to the Immigration Reform and Control Act, or the Simpson-Mazzoli Act, which had to do with certain protections of those who were eligible for amnesty programs and trying to prevent discrimination that would come from the act. The act, I mean, as you know, wound up producing discrimination against people who were of darker skin colors in the workplace. And I guess my point where I'm going with this is, even though there's a lot of rhetoric on the right about immigration policy today, it mostly seems like this notion of the those who are stealing our jobs are the ones that are coming in has, I guess, up and vanished. The real terror is for most people who are on the right today is that one day they'll look around and their neighbors won't look like them anymore. And that's a real cultural fear that you outlined at the beginning. And while the federal job guarantee might address some of the economic concerns. I still am sort of scared of the way that the right talks about the way people look and the racism that comes from that. It's just fundamentally racist problems. And I think the reason why I bring up the Simpson-Mazzoli Act is because in some ways you can point to that as a potential banner herald of the rights, fighting for these rights, but also harboring this tension at the same time. I don't know if that's a clear question, but more of a comment, I suppose.
Well, I think it's important to look at the history of immigration policy in this country and to look at it in connection with two factors that have different consequences. One is, what is one's policy to immigration in general? And the other is the policy that one has with regard to the naturalization of those who have immigrated. Now, for the first 100 years of the United States, we had open borders with completely unrestricted immigration. Anyone could come in. There were no visas. There were no such things as undocumented people, because you needed no documents to enter the country. And this, in a sense, was part of what made it so easy for people to come to the United States and make a new life here. But from the beginning, there was a restrictive naturalization policy. And the Constitution, in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 4, gives Congress the power to establish a uniform rule of naturalization. It would apply to all immigrants. Now, when we're talking about naturalization, we're talking about the process whereby an immigrant comes to obtain United States citizenship, which is needed in order to exercise political freedoms. You needed to vote. You needed to hold elective office. Now, the first Naturalization Act of 1790 was restrictive in a way that reflects the very concerns you're speaking about that we now see embodied on the right that is moving in what frankly can be called a fascist direction. Namely, in the 1790 Naturalization Act, the only people who could be naturalized, who had, you could say, a path to citizenship, were free white persons of good moral character who had resided 2 years in the United States and 1 year in a current state of residence. In 1795, this act was revised and, in a sense, made more restrictive. You had to have 5 years of residency and 3 years of notice of intention to apply for citizenship. And then in 1798, this was increased even further. In order to be naturalized, you had to be 14 years in residence and give 5 years' notice. Now, the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, in a way, could be seen to represent a blow to any of these restrictions on naturalization, in at least the sense that it opened citizenship to all persons who were born in the United States. And we all know that Donald Trump has raised objections. He's even claimed that he had the power through an executive order to remove this essential clause of the 14th Amendment, because what does it do? This notion that anyone born in the United States is a full-fledged citizen is a key element in a way preventing the United States from becoming an ancestral nation state, a state in which rights of citizenship or rights of any sort are to be based on ancestry. Now, we saw in these early naturalization laws a racial restriction. Nonetheless, immigration itself was completely unrestricted. That began changing 100 years later in the 1870s and 1880s, where you had the first laws that set any kind of controls on immigration itself. The very first federal immigration statute was the Page Act of 1875. And what it did, in a way, was to bar from immigration a certain group of potential immigrants from East Asia. It barred former convicts, prostitutes, people who were engaged, who were being almost like indentured laborers, who were brought in. And this was followed not long after by the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, to which you referred, which basically excluded Chinese laborers for another 10 years. Now, of course, there'd been a big influx of Chinese laborers, particularly in the western United States, who were involved in building the railways and a lot of other things involving the new growth of California and other western states. The Chinese Exclusion Act was extended for another 10 years. And in a way, it was made unlimited in 1902, so that Chinese were excluded from immigrating. And this was not repealed until 1943. Now, you had other kinds of limitations on immigration that took place at the same time. An 1882 law banned people who suffered from any kind of mental disabilities, who were carriers of infectious disease, who were anarchists. This occurred through the Anarchist Exclusion Act of 1901 after McKinley's assassination by an anarchist. And the Immigration Act of 1917 extended exclusions to illiterates. It's a good thing that my grandmother on my mother's side got here before that act, because she remained illiterate throughout her life. It also barred homosexuals. Then, in 1921, you had for the first time an Emergency Quota Act that began to establish national immigration quotas. And the idea was to try to maintain the ethnic character of the United States. And this was done by setting up quotas that were supposed to reflect the number of people of each nationality living in the U.S., first of all, as determined by the 1910 census. You had a 1924 Immigration Act, which did something similar. It effectively banned all immigration from Asia. And how did it do that? It basically changed the reference from the 1910 census to the 1890 census. And that was also done to reduce immigrants from Southern and Eastern Europe, because, again, it had to do with what was the population count of different ethnic groups before the major influxes of these populations. Now, immigration was actually shut down entirely in 1932 by Hoover during the Great Depression. And this was accompanied by a coerced repatriation of Mexican immigrants of up to 2 million, according to some accounts. Now, there has been a counter move against these kind of national exclusions. And, you know, if we want to understand where we are now, we have to understand what has happened since. This began in 1943 with the repeal of the Chinese exclusion immigration law. There was the 1946 Loose Seller Act, which ended discrimination against Indian Americans and Filipinos. And then you had the 1952 Immigration and Nationality Act, which omitted racial distinctions but did keep anti-subversive clauses. And you had under Eisenhower a major kind of anti-immigrant move called Operation Wetback, which deported over 1 million Mexicans. Now, the real change occurred in 1965 under President Lyndon Johnson, who really, you know, probably more than any president since FDR, introduced measures that really changed the character of this nation in a way, overcoming many of the racial and ethnic distinctions that had been left in place. This is the 1965 Immigration and Nationality Act. And this abolished national origin quotas. And instead, it introduced different kinds of categories. It gave preference to people who had certain desired skills. It opened the door to refugees and asylum seekers, irrespective of where they're coming from. And it also opened the door for immigration of family members of United States citizens. Now, the use of what could be called by Donald Trump of chain migration, that is allowing family relations to be a basis for immigration, was actually something that was regarded as a kind of compromise by those who were wary of lifting all of these national restrictions. Because the view was that if you allowed for immigration of family relatives, that would tend to retain the ethnic composition of the country. Now, you know, we know that that's not the case. Because obviously you have to have people who want to come here. And it's turned out that despite the fact that family relations have been a basis of immigration, so that, you know, a couple of years ago when immigration was still going and had not yet been shut down by Donald Trump, 70% of the people who came in based upon family connections. Now, immigration limits have been gradually increased up until Trump. And this has also included opening the door to taking in refugees and asylum seekers. You know, we have a law, the Refugee Reform Act of 1980, which in a way sort of compounds the United Nations Protocol of 1961, of which we are a signatory. Both of these laws basically indicate that we cannot legitimately turn away asylum seekers. We must enable them to enter our country, and we have to fairly consider their applications and treat them humanely while their cases are being examined.
Talking about sort of the demographic of the people who will be or have come into this country, one of the lowest is actually based off of employment. Especially in relation to other nations of similar stature, like Australia. This is something that the right sometimes uses as an excuse to say, oh, well, we're pro-immigrant. We just want those who are gainfully employed to come and spread their skills here. But at the same time, this seems like something that the federal job guarantee would pick up as well, having to do with trying to bring in specialized medical personnel, for example, is something I know you've mentioned, if it was lacking, that we could, I don't know, headhunt or scout these, particularly good, employees to come into our country. I guess, what exactly, could you expand on maybe that idea? And also, there could be a potential profiling problem with that as well.
Yeah, I mean, keep in mind that many of the restrictions pertaining to national origin were removed by the 1965 Act. And in a way, there were four pillars of immigration that were presented as being the basis of a new, more just immigration policy. One is that we would be guided in our immigration policy by a humanitarianism, where we would treat refugees and asylum seekers with respect and not shut our doors to them. The other was the idea of family unification, that we are going to recognize that family ties are of key importance and that we should allow immigration to solidify those ties. Then there was a concern with employment needs. You know, that our nation does have certain employment needs where we can make use of new immigrant labor. And this was to be thought of as involving employment needs of all sorts, of both skilled and unskilled people. And then also there was the notion that to overcome all of the kind of ancestral limitations that had prevailed in the past, we wanted to affirm diversity. And we wanted to have a certain space in our immigration policies to allow people to enter our nation and enhance its diversity as something of inherent value. Now, Donald Trump has, in a way, introduced policies, primarily by executive action, to really curtail all of these for pillars of what had come to be seen as a humane immigration policy. First of all, he has clamped down on asylum. He's done it to begin with by narrowing the grounds for asylum, by removing as a grounds for asylum seeking, the flight of people from cartel violence, gang violence, and from domestic abuse. This occurred in June 2018. These had previously been grounds for asylum. He also introduced, as we all know, in December of 2018, a program which basically prevented asylum seekers from coming into this country and to process their asylum claims. Instead, they had to remain in Mexico while awaiting asylum hearings, which would take place in the U.S. What that meant was they weren't in a position to be able to meet with any kind of legal aid. They were subject to all the problems of being stuck on the border in Mexico. And what resulted was that 0.1% of them gained asylum compared to the previous rate of 20%. And generally, there's been a sharp decline of asylum admittances under Trump. In 2016, before he took office, about 85,000 people were granted asylum. In 2017, the Trump administration capped asylum admissions at 45,000, reduced it the year later to 30,000. In 2019, it was capped at 19,000. And since October 1st of 2019, no asylum seekers have been admitted into the country. In addition, Trump introduced a Muslim ban, where he completely excluded anyone from 7 majority Muslim nations, irrespective of any kind of examination of whether there were any genuine reasons to exclude them from immigration. We know that he also challenged the birthright citizenship clause, which in a way is a first step in renewing the kind of both racial and ethnic privileging that we've been trying to move away from. And then, of course, he's increased the raids of ICE, of our enforcement agency, by deporting people for minor crimes instead of, or even for just mere accusations of crime. Whereas in the past, the only people who would be deported would be those who had been found to have committed serious crimes that could be said to threaten public safety. Now ICE is going around picking up anyone they can. And of course, they're doing this by getting these detainers from local law enforcement, where if law enforcement picks up anyone who might potentially be undocumented, ICE is asking for them to be detained after they would ordinarily be released and handed over to ICE. Now, at one point, this had been allowed if the people in question were accused of engaging in very serious crimes. Now that limitation has been left off. And that's really tantamount to holding people in detention really without any real justification, because they're being held in the jails for charges that have not yet gone through the judicial process, and they're now being released on some sort of bail, which they are entitled to. There's really no legitimate grounds for them to be kept in further detention, which is what these detainers involve. In addition, as we know, Trump has wanted to cancel the DACA program, which at least offered continued legal status to young people who had parents enter the country without authorization, but had spent almost all their life here. And Trump, of course, is trying to challenge that program. He's also trying to cancel the temporary protective status program, where people from nations who are undergoing some tremendous crisis were allowed to enter the United States, and many have been here for decades. This includes 59,000 Haitians, 200,000 Salvadorans, 2,500 Nicaraguans. Now he wants to throw them back. And then, of course, we have his zero tolerance policy regarding people who enter the country without authorization, whereby they will be put immediately in detention. And often that's in these for-profit detention centers for immigrants. And what this has meant is that children are separated from their parents and held in their own detention. And this has led to 3,000 children being separated from their families, and a fifth have still not been reunited. And in certain cases, the United States doesn't even know where the parents are. There was an order in June 2018 to end these family separations, but how? By basically detaining the entire families entirely. And then in addition, Trump has tried to bar any kind of green card consideration, that is any kind of obtaining of permanent residency for immigrants who are not having sufficient wealth. If they're poor, if at any point they've made use of public benefits for more than 12 months in any three-year period, they're not going to be allowed to obtain permanent residency. And in addition, he has terminated medical deferred action, where people in this country were allowed to stay to complete receiving necessary medical attention. Now he's barred that. He's increasing immigration fees. And as a result of all of these activities, immigration has fallen. Before the pandemic hit us, to the lowest level in more than a decade, to about 200,000. And there are projections that if we allow immigration to remain at such a small level, our GDP is going to fall by $1 trillion in a decade. And now Trump, with the pandemic, has completely shut down immigration. And this is going to provide really long-term consequences, because we have an aging population, a population that is not really able to reproduce itself without some degree of immigration. And we're going to be facing major problems as a nation unless we are in a position to provide a more humane treatment. And it's worth thinking about what the proper reform should be.
So in what ways should, tomorrow Joe Biden gets elected president or something like that, and what steps should he take to try and correct some of these wrongs besides just repealing them?
Yeah. Well, first of all, let's deal with the problem of refugees and asylum seekers. We do not have any legitimate reason to prevent them from entering our country. And when they enter our country, they should be availed of free legal representation and due process. There is no reason to detain any, unless they have obviously been involved in activities that would seem to pose a threat to public safety. And instead of putting them into detention, we can simply give them, electronic bracelets and keep track. And another big problem that we face in our processing of visas is that we have both a severe shortage of officials and immigration judges to rule on asylum cases. And as a result, there is a 7-year wait to even get through to the hearings one needs to enter into. We really need to shorten this for several reasons. First, just for the sake of being humane to the people in question so they can get on with their lives, but also to eliminate abuse. Because given that people have to wait 7 years on average to even get their asylum case resolved, that means that there are people who are gaming the system. They get entry on an asylum application, and then they disappear in the woodwork. But if we can keep the process short with adequate staffing and keep it to 6 months, then this problem of gaming the system and abuse will be removed. People who are applying can get on with their lives, and we can treat fairly our fair share of dealing with refugees and asylum seekers, as we should. Then we have the problem of the undocumented. We have what was a peak of over 12 million, now it's down to 11 million undocumented individuals who have been in our country on an average. I mean, most of them have been here for more than a decade. A very small proportion have been here less than 5 years. We have allowed them to be here. We have allowed employers to take advantage of them. and pay them low wages and abuse them of their rights. And in important ways, we have contributed to their presence here through policies we've had to countries south of the border, where most of these undocumented people have been coming from. Namely, we've had the war on drugs, which has fabulously enriched the cartels, who have a reign of violence from which millions are fleeing for their lives. We've had NAFTA and other economic agreements that have flooded nations south of the border with American agricultural products that are driving peasant agriculture out of business. We have our lax gun laws, which have allowed the cartels to arm themselves to the teeth and create havoc south of the border. In all these ways, we have failed to really create conditions where there is a just law and order, where people do not have to flee for their lives, where people can actually live decently without having to leave family and home behind. And if we want to really remove the causes that have pushed so many people across the border, we need to think of having a Marshall Plan for these nations, which will provide for economic development, for enforcing a social bill of rights south of the border. We also need to end the war on drugs and legalize personal drug use and put the cartels out of business. We have to restrict gun purchases in a way so that the cartels cannot arm themselves in the teeth in the U.S. and ship their guns back across the border. I mean, these are the kind of measures that can deal with the root problem. And that also involves also in our foreign policy, not propping up oppressive regimes south of the border from which people want to flee. So if we're going to deal with this 11.2 million mass of people who've been working hard, have been in a way contributing to our economic welfare, we need to give them a path to not only legal status, but eventually to citizenship, because we don't want to have a class of residents who are these drones who do the work but are deprived of political freedom. So on the one hand, I think the easy way of doing it is to say anyone who's been in this country more than a year will be able to obtain legal status, which will allow them to avail themselves of all of one's social rights, enable them to travel back home and back here again. And then they'll be able to then enter the process to get permanent residency and with green cards and a path to citizenship. And this will then put us in a position to really improve the labor standards in the country as a whole, because we won't have this large group of people who are working under the shadows, who are always worrying about being illegal. They will be able to stand up for their rights, and that will be good for our nation as a whole. And in that regard, we need also to provide legal status to the DACA and the TPS, a population, people who came here and have been living their lives for decades and contributing to the country. We should give them legal status and an option for permanent residency and citizenship if they want to take it. And I think these are major reforms that need to be taken as part of comprehensive immigration reform. I think we also need to increase the quotas for people coming in on various kinds of work visas, because our economic growth, in a way, depends upon a growing labor force, and we have room for letting in people. And we should not be excluding people who are in low-skilled professions. We should open our doors to people of any occupation. Definitely. And likewise, we need to increase the quotas for people coming in for chain migration, for family reunification. And to handle all of this and get rid of the backlogs, we really need to put huge amount of resources, not into building walls, but increasing the staff, not of ICE agents, but of officials who process claims and immigration judges, so that people can get through the system. Because there are gigantic backlogs. You know, there's been a situation where Different countries now have sort of equal quotas, but that means that if you're coming from India or China or Mexico, you have to wait far more years than you do if you're coming from a small nation like Malta, for example. So these are the kind of reforms that can allow for a fair immigration policy that will allow us to really continue to grow and be vibrant and be a diverse nation and a nation that fulfills the ideal of going beyond the ancestral parochialism of a nation state and becomes a nation where citizens are citizens because they subscribe to our Constitution, where anyone born here will be a citizen, no matter what your ancestry. And I think these are principles that give our nation a special appeal and a special authority that we need to sustain. And if we fulfill the social rights agenda, in particular, with a federal job guarantee, fair wages, employee empowerment, no one will have to worry about having their livelihood or welfare jeopardized by our country continuing to be a beacon of immigration.
Right. Well, thank you very much. All these points about, seeing the vicious circle of the foreign policy, also understanding that some of the issues of employees' rights and particularly undocumented employees' rights comes down to a federal job guarantee. I mean, these are all very helpful in clarifying some of the issues we see in America today. So,
And I think it's important to recognize we want to keep the path to naturalization open.
Right.
We don't want to be a nation of guest arbeiters, Gastarbeiter, or people who come here who work but are deprived of political freedom because they have no path to citizenship. We want to be a democratic nation in the true sense of the term, and a nation, a democracy that fulfills the democratic project by not being defined by any specific race or ethnicity, but a nation that is open to anyone who wants to exercise their freedoms.